Thank you very, very much, Nicholas, and thank you all for coming, especially all of you who are here coming for this, joining us for this early bird panel. So we appreciate that, and we'll make sure that you get your worm, kind of really nice, juicy worm out of the information from these panelists. And what we thought we would do, especially today with this weather, is maybe do kind of like a fireside chat, just kind of discuss, interactive. I'm going to ask each panelist a question to answer the title of our panel, Are Closed-End Funds a Value Proposition Today? But hopefully it will become very interactive, and we also hope that we're going to have some time for Q&A. So we're going to start with John Bartlett from Reefs on my far left, and he's going to tell us about the value proposition of the actual structure, the structure of a closed-end fund. So, John, tell us about the benefits of the closed-end fund structure.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Let me just take a couple of seconds of introduction here and background. I'm John Bartlett. I'm a portfolio manager at Reeves Asset Management. Our single largest product is our closed-end fund, which trades under the ticker symbol UTG. It's the Reeves Utility Income Fund. It has about $1.5 billion of assets. The performance has been pretty good. We've been at this since 2004. For all the utility funds that are out there with a 10-year track record, we're number one. And I think for all closed-end funds generally, we've been fortunate enough to be somewhere in the top 20. So it's been a good run. We've been able to consistently raise the dividend over time. And that's something that we're particularly proud of because, you know, for us, it's not just income, it's growth of income, and we really do strive to find good, solid utility and other companies. The portfolio right now is about 80% utilities, and then, you know, we have capabilities elsewhere in telecom and in energy, so we augment it with that. By and large, we try to buy conservative companies with the ability to grow their dividend every year, and that's kind of translated into our ability to grow UTG's dividend. We also have an actively managed ETF, which is a sort of newer venture for us. Anyway, I would say that when you sort of look back at our cumulative experience, the best part of having a closed-end fund is that it allows us to manage money like a business. It enables us to, as I said earlier, invest for total return, not just for income. And when I reflect on the industry with which I'm most comfortable, which is the utility business, which is really part of my DNA at this point, you know, utilities are kind of a funny industry. I think it's one of the few industries that's actually out there where investors tend to underpay for growth. They tend to overpay for income. And so for us, having a closed-end fund with the ability to, you know, manage around a very predictable income stream that we give to our shareholders allows us to get involved in utilities that might not otherwise be eligible for a sort of a levered fund. I'd also say that, in fact, the closed-end fund structure, because we have such big unrealized gains and because we do invest for some level of growth, enables us to keep less leverage than we might otherwise have to. And if I look at, you know, maybe why we've done better, I think acumen is probably part of it, but I think when I look at our colleagues that have sort of perished by the side of the road, quite frankly, it's because they've levered up in good times and been forced to delever in bad times. And what we have done with our closed-end fund is really use the advantages of the structure to keep leverage down and modify leverage on our terms, not the terms of the market. So those are really my feelings on that, Mariana. And I don't know if you have any questions, but just throw that out there.
Just one quick question that somebody was asking me about this yesterday. You talked about leverage, which I think is a fabulous benefit of the structure. But there are limits to it. It's not like some kind of a hedge fund that they can go crazy and lever up substantially. There are some limits. Can you tell us about that? And when the asset coverage ratios are violated, there are kind of safety valves too.
Frankly, I'm not all that familiar with them because we've never pushed it. We do fashion ourselves to keep leverage, at a reasonable level. There are structural things that, you have to keep in mind of in terms of watching your leverage. And obviously, if you max things out, you have to be very cognizant of a market correction and having to adapt to that. We really have tried, and I think successfully, even if you go back to the financial crisis, done a pretty good job of sort of staying ahead of the law on that.
Right. In the cases where funds have violated those asset coverage ratios, has happened very rarely. In the almost a quarter of a century that I've been covering closed-end funds, I can think of two market scenarios, 08, and in very specifically MLPs for when the MLP market came down in 15. So besides that, I can't think of any other case where.
Yeah, well, there's the violating the letter of the law, and then there's having to run for cover. And I think there are plenty of funds who've had to run for cover from time to time.
Let's move on to Bob Bush from Calamos, and he's going to tell us about. Discounts. I guess it wouldn't be a panel on closed-end funds if we didn't talk about discounts. So,
right.
Bob, tell us about valuations, where they've been, where they are.
Sure.
About that.
Sure. Well, after 2015, the closed-end fund market undercame quite a bit of stress, and there's a number of reasons for that. And it's usually the same cast of suspects. It's generally driven by the fear of rising interest rates, and that obviously that war drum has been going on for a while now. But the fear of rising interest rates affects the market's perception of closed-end funds for two reasons. One, obviously, is the fear that the increased leverage costs, which many funds employ, is somehow going to impede the ability of that fund to maintain its distribution. The other aspect is the impact of a deteriorating bond market on the underlying securities in a closed-end fund. That relates to, which obviously would deteriorate when interest rates rise. I think what happens so much in the closed-end fund space is a misunderstanding and a miscommunication. And I credit you all for coming here because I think this is an area which clearly is undercovered, it's misunderstood, and it's really under research. And that's not a diss to you, Marianne. I mean, it's the research analysts that are out there are quality people, professionals that do a great job. Unfortunately, there aren't enough of them, and so there's just not enough coverage. But there are times when this space can come under stress, which doesn't necessarily make sense. So, for example, in an environment where you do have a rising interest rate, but you have a closed-end fund which has exposure to equities or lower duration fixed income products, like fixed income, for example, our closed-end funds, we have a lot of convertibles in them and a lot of high yield. Well, high yield and convertibles are lower duration, obviously, and they're going to be less impacted by a rising interest rate. They're still going to supply income, but you're still going to get equity upside in a managed way. And so, in theory, in a rising interest rate environment, which we may be on the brink of, equity should improve. But the market doesn't look at it like that. The market doesn't look under the hood and see what goes on in these portfolios. It just assumes that they're all bonds and they're going to trade like bonds because they have big incomes associated with them. One factor, I think, which is important, everybody asks, what's sort of the down and dirty way to assess whether the valuation of a fund is good today versus where it was in the past or maybe in the future. There's this thing called the Z-score. The research community knows about it, and many investors know about it, but to those in the audience that don't, it's simply taking the current discount, subtracting the average discount, and dividing that by the standard deviation. And this can be done for any period of time. Naveen, to their credit, has a website where they put out, I think, the 3-month, the 6-month, and the 1-year. We typically look at it since the inception of the fund. And what this will do is basically assuming a normal distribution rate of discounts, give you a sense as to where it falls. So, for example, many closed-end funds at the end of last year were trading at minus one Z-score, which means that only 16% of the time since that period of time, they have traded worse than that. So on average, those funds are well below average at that point in time. So I think you have to factor that in the equation, but you also have to factor out, well, what's the underlying here? What's going on? So, for example, take a convertible fund like we have, CHY, for example. We were trading at double-digit discounts at the end of last year. Now, the average discount on CHY since inception is actually a 4% premium, and that goes back to 2003. So it's a fairly long period of time, including 08. Okay, well, what, people are afraid of rising rates. Well, all right, what are you borrowing at? Well, we're borrowing at LIBOR plus. So basically we're paying maybe 1.3% on our leverage. Okay. Is your duration low? Yes. It's less than 4 years. Okay. So you're not long duration. All right. Are you more than earning your cost of leverage? Well, yes, we are, because if you look at what bonds have done, equities have done, convertibles have done, we're more than earning it. Okay, well then why should this, and this fund historically is traded at premium, yes, why should this be paying it at a 10% discount? Well, it shouldn't if you think that all the aspects of what this fund invests in are going to improve. It's probably a hell of a buy. And so I think if I could leave you with one aspect, look at these closed-end funds, assess what their valuation is, using the Z-score as a tool, and invest in them when you see that opportunity, not only depending on the macroeconomics of what's going on, but exactly what these specific funds invest in, because they are very different vehicles.
I completely agree. When you said that the closed-end fund market is inefficient, absolutely, which is one of the reasons I love covering closed-end funds. It's one of those few small niche areas that you can add a lot in terms of doing a little bit of research. Sometimes somebody asks me, there must be something wrong with this closed-end fund because it's trading at a double-digit discount. There must be something wrong. No, not necessarily. So it pays to do a little bit of research.
It does. And just one last point. Oftentimes, these will trade, they'll swoon at year end. Why? Because of cash needs, tax requirements, tax loss selling. So broker will go to customer, Mrs. Jones, and say, Mrs. Jones, we've got to do some movement here in your portfolio. You can sell Apple, or you can sell XYZ closed-end fund. Well, Mrs. Jones falls in love with Apple. You fall in love with a stock. You typically don't fall in love with a closed-end fund. So the closed-end fund will get thrown overboard for no fault of its own. Just nobody. She doesn't know why she owns it and can't associate with it. That will exacerbate some of these pressures that come on the general market. So maybe a good time to come back in January, rule of thumb, and take a look at that fund.
Or even after Christmas.
After Christmas, yeah.
And people who have gone through this, investors who have gone through this, they know, and they're there to pick up. And maybe Jim will tell us a little bit more about that in a moment. But let's move to David from Ares. He's going to tell us now at the portfolio level how are funds kind of taking advantage and providing value for investors.
Thank you, Mariana. First of all, I'm a senior partner and was a co-founder of Ares 20 years ago. We're about approximately $100 billion assets under management with $65 billion in credit. And we have two closed-end funds, Ares Dynamic Credit Allocation Fund, ARDC, where I'm chairman, and a newer interval fund, Scion Ares Diversified Credit, with our partners at Scion Securities. And the bottom line answer to the question on the panel is, are they a value proposition? Absolutely. And both of the prior panelists talked about reasons. I agree with John that the structure gives you an enormous advantage for the type of investing we do at Ares over pure open-end funds, which do serve a purpose. And that is, besides the leverage, as John said, you can invest on a total rate of return basis. You can hold assets that, while they may be liquid, have less liquidity. And also, you can do things different than an ETF. So, for example, today in the high-yield market, the way our portfolio within the ARDC, which is about 40% high-yield, is configured, is we have a portfolio that has an interest rate duration of a little over 3 years compared to the Merrill Lynch high-yield index of 4. Why is that? Well, we're not scared that the 10-year Treasury is going to 4 or 5% soon. The Federal Reserve has certainly indicated which direction rates are going. Of course, that had been hanging over the fixed income market at various points since Bernanke and the taper tantrum in 2012, but it actually seems to be happening now with two rate increases so far, over the last 6-9 months and more coming. And we've been able to have that shorter duration portfolio in the part of our portfolio that is high yield without sacrificing return. In fact, the OAS, which is another tactical measure of value, the option-adjusted spread on that portfolio, is 421 as of March 31 versus 390 for the Merrill Lynch High Yield Index. And from a credit standpoint, the portfolio is the same average B+, B2 ratings that you would have on the Merrill Lynch High Yield Index. So by buying a closed-end fund, whether it be in utilities, as John has, in convertibles, as Robert mentioned, where we are in leveraged credit, you have the opportunity to, frankly, not buy the index and to tailor where the portfolio should be, given where you are in the cycle, whether that be a credit cycle, interest rate cycle, et cetera. One of the other things that the structure of the fund has allowed us to do is devote about 25-30% of the portfolio to a structured credit asset, which is underlying all leveraged loans, which are CLOs. CLOs are sort of also misunderstood. So you have an misunderstood asset class in closed-end funds, which, as we've talked about, are under-researched. And CLOs are just pools of leveraged loans, the same loans that are in senior loan closed-end funds. And then they are tranched. The double B tranches of CLOs, we have about 20% of the portfolio in those. Today, that at par, those assets are delivering a discount margin of somewhere between 550 to 700 over LIBOR. So you compare that to where a double B loan itself is, a double B loan is somewhere in the, call it 250 to 350 over LIBOR. So now, while CLOs maybe trade $1 billion a week, and leveraged loans trade a lot more, so there's less liquidity. But the structure of a closed-end fund allows you to hold these type of assets and deliver alpha to your investors. As an example, a couple of years ago, that portfolio, we bought mostly a discount double B tranches, probably at prices 92 to 96 over the sort of 3 years to 18 months ago at discount. Those securities have appreciated today because the market at that point thought they would be 8-year average life securities. So you're buying something in 92, they're implying what the yield to maturity or discount margin of maturity. Now, given changes in the CLO market time, they're viewed as 5-year securities. We've been selling that portion of our portfolio between 98 and 100, and which implies a discount margin of, call it, 475 to 525, and rotating the portfolio over the last couple of months into newer double B CLO tranches with discount margins of 600 to 700 basis points. So an enormous value pickup. We've achieved capital gains in that asset class for our investors and allows them access to something they couldn't otherwise get. I should also say, when I stress that they're misunderstood, no rated tranche of a CLO has ever defaulted. So unlike other types of structured credit, subprime mortgages, which of course got all the press a few years ago, this is an asset class that is generally not available to retail investors, and that closed-end fund structure allows us to hold.
And here, given that the portfolio you're talking about, ARDC, has less liquid securities, I want to emphasize, if we were to compare that portfolio in an open-end fund, and if there were a lot of redemptions or a lot of concern about the market, and which creates a lot of redemptions, the portfolio manager, maybe the open-end portfolio manager, may be stuck having to try to sell them, maybe can't, or if he or she can do that at probably very low prices, while the closed-end fund manager has the luxury of just sitting tight, assuming they still like the CLOs, and doesn't need to touch the portfolio, doesn't need to touch those securities. Now, to be fair, maybe the discount of the closed-end fund widens a bit in a case like that, but then the savvier investor can take advantage of that and get in. So I think that's another benefit.
And even today, it's sort of interesting, the value proposition question of the panel, in the credit area, which I know the best, others on the panel can talk about other asset classes, even with discounts down significantly over the last 12 to 18 months, you still see a lot of value. if you look at where the 3 and 6 month treasury bills are at 80 and 95 basis points, you can buy a senior loan fund at 6.71. You can buy the ARDC at over 7% market distribution rate, and the duration of our fund is less than 1.5 years on interest rate. So you're not taking tremendous interest rate risk.
Great. Thank you, David. Now, I left Jim is our last panelist, but that doesn't mean that I think he offers a very special perspective in this panel because he's not coming from a closed-end fund sponsor. He's actually an investor, like many of you. So I think that's why I left him kind of at the end, kind of the special, not the special panel, I'm sorry, but panelist, but a special perspective. So Jim is with, Jim Robinson is with Robinson Capital, based in Michigan, and he's going to tell us how he finds value in closed-end funds. Tell us a little bit about your firm and how you look
sure.
at closed-end funds.
By way of background, I stumbled into the closed-end fund world after the carnage of the post-Lehman environment. After Lehman went down, anyone could pick up a newspaper and see that the stock market was down 30%. What most people weren't reading was that the credit markets were down even more. Senior bank loans were down 38%, high yield was down 40%, preferreds were down 40-something percent. That's not intuitive. All those asset classes rank above stocks in the capital structure, so it's not intuitive that they would be down as much, let alone more, than the stock market. So we knew there was an arbitrage opportunity there. When I went to fill certain asset classes, things like senior bank loans, I discovered the wonderful world of closed-end funds. We've had a couple of panelists mention inefficiencies in the market. I would claim that the closed-end fund space is one of the last bastions of inefficiency in public markets. And it's because of the retail nature of the product. When mom and pop get spooked, they do irrational things, like sell their closed-end funds. So we've been arbitraging closed-end funds through a couple of hedge funds since late 2008, early 2009. In September of 2014, we launched a tax-advantaged open-ended fund that invests in tax-exempt closed-end funds and then hedges out some of the duration risk. And then the beginning of 2016, we launched a sister fund to that fund, the Robinson Opportunistic Income Fund, which invests in taxable closed-end funds and hedges out some of the credit risks and some of the duration risks. There is clearly a seasonal effect in the space, as others have discussed. You know, one of the things that we do probably around August is start looking at which asset classes are down in value on a year-to-date basis, because those are likely going to be the funds that get sold in the tax loss harvesting season. So you don't want to be holding those funds if there's a lot of selling pressure going on. Our data suggests that really it's actually before Christmas that you want to get back into those funds. Most of the tax loss selling gets done by typically the first week in December. But getting in at or around Christmas is a pretty good time to get back into the funds that have been beaten up in tax loss harvesting season. Today, where we find value, and just for full disclosure, at different points in time, I have owned each of these gentlemen's funds.
Good.
Still own CHY and still owning RDC. Where we see value today, and you know, this time a year ago, we felt like the whole preferred stock space was overvalued, and certainly the closed-end funds in the preferred stock space were all trading at or above NAV. So we got out of it, and after Brexit and rates started rising and then the election, by late November, the whole preferred space, A, had gotten really beaten up. B, it's widely misunderstood by retail investors. For whatever reason, they think that the durations are much longer than they actually are. So they really got taken out to the woodshed. Discounts widened out to 6-8%. For an asset class that 6 months earlier, 9 months earlier, was trading at premiums. So, you know, we rotated into that space. And the senior bank loan space, which we loved a year ago, is now getting to be a bit of a crowded trade. I would characterize the whole senior bank loan space as being somewhat covenant light. There's a heck of a lot of money flying into senior bank loans because investors rightfully believe that they will be protected in a Fed rising rate environment. But when there's so much money out there, the covenants on those loans have gotten pretty soft, and borrowers can pretty much dictate terms these days. So we've been lightening up on the senior bank loan space. We do love high yield, and you know, we look at funds a little differently. We try to understand or explain as much of the discount as we possibly can. It's only the irrational portion of the discount that's arbitrageable. So why would a fund trade at a discount? Well, one of the first screens that we do is, how has the manager performed on an NAV basis? A manager who is consistently outperforming his peers, his benchmark, you could make a case that he probably should trade at a premium. You want that guy managing your money. A manager who consistently underperforms benchmark and peers probably deserves to trade at a discount. If the fund holds difficult to value securities, if you don't believe the NAV, then of course you're going to apply a haircut to it. And then, you know, their cost and use of leverage. Are they paying more than their peers? Are they paying less than their peers? Are they more levered, less levered? Most of those are quantifiable factors. The last step in our process is the governance of the underlying fund. Is this a fund company that has historically stepped in to support their fund prices when discounts have gotten too wide? You know, so BlackRock has a group of funds where if they trade below a certain threshold, it'll initiate an automatic share buyback. Naveen last year went through a big scrutiny of their entire closed-end fund platform. Naveen's one of those fund companies on the muni side that had a chronic discount problem. And they had done all the right things from a governance perspective. They'd done share buybacks. They'd done tender offers. At the end of the day, the problem that they were facing was just confusion. They have 30 different tax-exempt closed-end funds. There aren't that many nuances in tax-exempt securities to have 30 different funds. And so last year they did a series of mergers where they eliminated 17 tax-exempt closed-end funds and merged them into four surviving funds. Our favorite by far is the tender offer. We don't see them as often anymore, but even if I don't have a position in a fund, if they announce a tender offer, I'll probably take a position in that fund. Retail investors apparently don't read their mail. Participation rates in tender offers are almost always sub 50%. So I know I'm going to get taken out of the lion's share of my shares in a tender offer. So that's what we do.
David, you
I'd just like to follow up because on the comment that Jim just made in his about the senior loan space, and I think his comment is right. There's a lot of money flowing in, and that's often a yellow warning light, so to speak, about an asset class because over long term, assets have fundamental value. Over short term, as he talked about post Lehman in 08, they're commodities. If too many people want to sell them, it doesn't matter whether they're oranges or high-yield bonds, the price is going to go down. And so senior loan space, besides the retail flows that Jim mentioned, is seeing a tremendous buying interest from institutions because even though spreads have tightened on senior loans, they're quite cheap. Double B loans are, frankly, still cheap to investment-grade fixed-rate corporate when you look on a option-adjusted basis. So if you're institution and you're focused on protecting just like an individual against a rise in rates, you might at the margin be shifting to floating rate assets. And then lastly, the CLO market is a big part of the buying demand for leveraged loans, and there's been tremendous activity there. Ares, as one of the top five issuers of CLOs, is quite aware of the technicals. So that means that this product, going back to the comment that John made originally, the structure allows, I think, frankly, more discerning purchase potentially, depends on the manager, of in your senior loan portfolio here than in an ETF. So you potentially, even though you are at risk from the weakening covenants and the tighter spreads, you, I think, likely will see better performance in the senior loans in the closed-end fund portfolios than, say, buying just a senior loan ETF.
Now, one question I have for you, Jim. You mentioned that you look at the NAV performance. What kind of time periods are you looking at?
The usual 1, 3, 5, 10, if they can go back that far. And then you also want to see the tenure of the manager. If it wasn't the same manager, then you got to scrub that a bit. Mm-hmm. So we try to look back as far as we possibly can. We look through the portfolios to see what they hold. If there's anything that gives us some angst, we'll usually hop on the phone with the portfolio manager and just discuss what are they thinking about a certain position. But we're trying to understand the strategy as much as possible and how the manager thinks and how the manager behaves. As I said, if a manager has consistently underperformed peers and benchmark, he may deserve to be trading at a discount.
Mm-hmm. If I may add a comment, we also look at NAV performance. We always want to make sure that we understand why there may have been some underperformance. There may be a difference in credit quality. There may be a difference in duration. There may be, in MLPs, one fund has more GPs than MLPs. So understanding those nuances between differences, rarely are two funds almost identical or very close. Sometimes the same manager, same asset class, there may be very, very different, and they may converge over time, the portfolios. But often there is something different. So we try not to punish a fund that appears to have underperformed when we then realize, oh, but there's this portion of the portfolio that is invested in another area, in a different section, because that may have underperformed, but maybe going forward, that's the area specifically that is more likely to outperform. And that's not easy to try to identify why exactly has it underperformed, or maybe slightly differently, why exactly is this NAV distribution rate a little bit higher than the peer group or a little bit lower? So we try to dig deeper as to, oh, I get it. It has this type of exposure that explains why the NAV rate is higher or maybe lower. So we try to not be tolerant of underperformance, but understand underperformance for a given period of time, because that may be exactly what we want now going forward.
Well, and peer groups can be arbitrary, as you know, Mariana.
Yes, I mean, it's very tough.
My background was an investment banker, and I in the closed-end fund space, the asset management business, and I put together a lot of closed-end funds over my prior life, and I can tell you that many times they're creative creatures, in other words, how you put them together. And so they're hybrids. You know, they'll oftentimes they'll invest a percentage in high yield or convertibles or senior loans or what have you. So for Morningstar or any other group to put them in a category, unlike the open-end space, which is pretty straightforward, you buy a high-yield fund, you get a high-yield fund. You buy a convertible, you get a convertible. Here, there are multiple products. They're hybrids. And so it's hard to sort of compare them against other groups. Sometimes they move them around on a regular basis just because the asset classes in that portfolio move because the portfolio manager thinks there's more of an opportunity in one area than another. So I think you kind of have to keep your eye on the ball there. I mean, one, again, down and dirty way to look at it is, okay, what has the holdings of this fund been over the course of the year? Well, they've averaged 60% convertible and 40% in high yield. Well, what's the convertible market done? What's the high yield market done? Look at that index. Look, you know, balance it based on that and use that as a metric. I mean, unfortunately, it's not all clean, and sometimes you have to roll up your sleeves, but you can get some real bargains here if you just do a little work and have just a sense of understanding of how it all works.
I'm really glad that you brought that up, Bob, because the categories and the peer groups sometimes are huge, and a lot of stuff is put in there that don't really look alike at all. Sometimes the peer groups are tiny, and so it's not really that meaningful. Now, given that this is a closed-end and ETF asset class, you mentioned some of your portfolios are a little bit of this, a little bit of that. We use the ETFs to give us an idea of, can we kind of recreate a benchmark that is X percent of this and X percent of that. So that is very useful, but I'm really glad you brought that up. So with that, we have 5 minutes, and maybe we can take some questions if you have any. Hopefully we've really woken you up with this conversation. Go ahead. Here, right here. Yes. They're bringing a microphone. Thank you.
Thank you all. Good morning. Being more of an ETF person than a closed-end fund individual, how do I really ascertain, because there's a finite number of shares, when I'm trying to look at a premium or discount, when we talk about trading volumes, you know, if there happens to be a lot of buyers in the market, can sort of make something trade at a premium. Is there a psychological aspect as opposed to sort of a more definitive quantitative aspect? Whoever wants to address that.
Yeah, I'm trying to make sure I
understand. Oh, I didn't say it was an easy question.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I'm trying to make sure I understand the question.
Right. ETF will trade around its NAV.
Right.
Closed-end fund, you might read in the popular press that, you know, this is a great buy because it's trading at an 8% discount. But if you go into a Bloomberg terminal, it's been at an 8% discount for 3 years. So as a more... as an investor, how do I make a more educated decision as to should it be there? What are some factors that we can use back in the trenches?
Yeah, if you have a Bloomberg, you're ahead of most. but that, you know, if you do have a Bloomberg, that's a good place to start because there's you can see historic discounts or premiums for the fund. One of the challenges with closed-end funds relative to ETFs is they are a little more thinly traded. I wouldn't call the space illiquid, but it's really a small-cap trade. It's not like buying Apple. You know, it was never part of our strategy.
I'm sorry, not even small-cap, micro-cap. Yeah. I've compared them.
Okay, but it was never part of our strategy. But I can tell you on almost a daily basis, some knucklehead in Topeka will hit the sell button on 20,000 shares of one of these funds at market, not realizing he's going to move the market. My trader's first reaction is to see, you know, verify that it is, in fact, a retail seller. If it's an institutional seller, we get a little nervous. but if it's a retail seller, we'll often provide the liquidity for that position and just park it and wait a couple weeks for the market to cure itself. Barron's puts out a list of most closed-end funds on a weekly basis with discounts, or you can go to the various websites. Pretty much every closed-end fund company has their own websites. They have fact sheets there. I mean, the information's there. I don't know if that answered your question or not. But
I would just add one thing to the last part of your question, and I'm a shorter-term observer of this than some of the others on the panel. But I do think there is one psychological factor I've seen is that if for whatever combination of macro market reasons or how the underwriter has placed the deal trades well in the first couple of months, it tends to trade better over time. And if unfortunately, even if the NAV performance of fund is average or above average, the fund comes to market at a time when afterwards that asset class goes out of favor or the deal isn't placed well, from just my anecdotal looking at both our fund and some others, that psychological factor has an impact because going back to the seasonal aspect, if the fund is traded poorly, people have a loss, and if they have gains in their retail portfolios of other stocks, that is one of the things that the broker will then go to sell and vice versa. If they have gain, they're less likely to want to take another taxable gain.
Right. One thing that I may add to Jim, there are a number of comparisons that we make for the discount. He mentioned that looking historically, where has the discount been for that fund? We also look at relative to the closed-end fund universe. Morningstar is helpful for that because they keep track of a number of series for average premium discounts for the universe. Then for the peer group, how does it trade relative to the peer group? Should it be trading at a deeper discount to the peer group or maybe richer to that. Sometimes the NAV distribution rate has something to do with that. And as David says, sometimes it's just psychological. If a fund has, because of pure timing more than anything, done poorly because that asset class has come down, many cases investors just don't want to touch that fund again. And it may be now a great buy, a fabulous buy, really cheap, great timing, but nobody wants to touch it because they just had that bad experience, which creates an opportunity for other people. So again, emphasizing one more time the inefficiency, the quirkiness of the closed-end fund universe, which in a way is wonderful for those who know how it works. We may have time for... Okay, we'll try here.
Just a question on the outlook for the sector. And what's the main growth drivers for the sector? Both talking about, you talked a bit about the closed-end funds, the bond side, but also the equity portion, because bonds make up the majority of the closed-end funds here. Just what are the drivers for the outlook for the sector, as in the closed-end fund sector?
I'm sorry, what are the...
Oh, sorry, I need to speak in a different language. What are the drivers, as in...
The drivers,
the sector, both the bond portion of the closed-end fund sector and the equity portion?
Within the closed-end fund?
Just for the growth in the sector.
As in new issuance or as in...
Yeah, new issues. Yeah.
I'm going to leave that to you, Marianne, because I...
Can we take a break on that and leave that for... I think there's another panel a little bit later, so we don't want to steal their thunder. Give them. So if you hold on for a little bit for the... I'm not sure it's the next panel, but I know there's another panel that we'll talk about that. So we'll take that question then for just a few seconds.
It seems as though the closed-end fund space is probably shrinking a little bit. In terms of, you don't see a lot of new funds, some of them go away. Can you just talk a little bit about how you think the space will develop, some of the changes? I mean, it seems as though we're seeing maybe more of these funds that term out and kind of guarantee a certain principal back, and sometimes they sell at these premiums, which, I don't particularly like. I mean, I wouldn't buy them. But anyways, the closed-end fund, and people may or may not know this, but closed-end funds are the original pooled investment. They existed before mutual funds. So, but anyways, just talk a little bit about what are some of the innovations or what are some of the characteristics of the newer funds and what the future holds vis-a-vis relative to the past for closed-end funds.
Well, that actually is another panel, but I don't want to take from them. But I'll give you a short answer and let that panel elaborate on it. And I'm on that one as well, so I'll look for you. Okay.
Thank you.
It evolves over time, and I think what's going on now is you're quite right. There have been fewer deals done; they've been smaller, and I think the reason is that the universe is a lot smaller. So these term deals that are getting done are 3 to 5 year terms. They're typically fixed income. They're either high yield or they're muni. The reason they're going into the term route is lower fees to the customer, lower fees not only on the sale but also in the management part of it. The concern that many of the IPOs have come out and after the green shoe period have dropped down considerably. And that's a whole other question and a whole other realm. But the idea is try to get NAV back to the customer, narrow that arbitrage, that spread between the price and the NAV, and the term structure satisfies that. That's the concern right now. Now, I will say, as a tickler for the next panel, which I'm on, I think the world does change, and as these discounts have narrowed for a whole host of reasons, which may very well... Part of it may be the fact that you're not getting a lot of new supply. Maybe that world will change a little bit too. But I want to give that to you now as an hors d'oeuvre. We'll give you the main course in the next chapter. Okay.
Thank you.
Great. And with that, thank you very much. This was really fun. I enjoyed it.